This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 306 was recorded on January 13th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. Patrick Serezna is off this week, so Kevin Muir will be joining me as co-host. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. 42 Macro founder Darius Dale joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Darius correctly called for a pause in the reflation trade last time he was on Macro Voices. This time, he says the reflation trade is making a comeback, but it will eventually yield to deflation. Then be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment when Kevin Muir and I will discuss an article that he just had published by Bloomberg titled, "The Bond Market Refuses to Accept Economic Reality."
And I'm Kevin Muir in for Patrick Serezna. Eric, before we get to the markets, let's start with a quick update on Omicron. What do you see on the horizon for both the pandemic and the markets?
Well, Kevin, the market is correctly discounting that Omicron is not going to be a big deal in the long run in the sense that it's not nearly as infectious. It doesn't result in the same number of hospitalizations or death as the previous more dangerous strains. However, I think the market may be failing to discount the possibility that over the next 2 to 3 weeks, and Dr. John Campbell says we have about 2 to 3 more weeks in the US and UK before we reach a peak number of cases with Omicron and everything goes into reverse and the numbers start going down. Those numbers could be pretty darn big. The R-naught, that's the transmissibility index of the original SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus, the alpha wave or the first wave that came out, was around 4.0, and that was super scary because it was such a high number. This one, Omicron, was believed to be 6.0, which is about the only thing other than measles that's that transmissive. Turns out new research this week says that Omicron may actually be even more transmissive than measles. That would be an R-naught of above 15. So it's really, really super contagious. Everybody on the planet is going to be exposed to this and many will be infected. Now, the good news is that many of those people are going to be completely asymptomatic. They'll have mild symptoms or no symptoms. It's not going to be that big of a deal. But we are already seeing very significant economic curveballs. Example, United Airlines had more than one-third of their Newark, New Jersey workforce call in sick the other day. That caused them to be forced to cancel a whole bunch of flights. We're nowhere close to the peak in Omicron cases. So I want our listeners to imagine the scenario where literally, for the first time in our lifetime, certainly, more than half of all workers call in sick for several days in a row at the same time. What are the indirect consequential knock-on effects and consequences of that? My contention is these things are very easy to see, like the example of United Airlines, in hindsight. But to anticipate them and see them coming is much more difficult. So I think there's a lot more curveballs like that that could kind of screw up the economy for the next month or two. After that, the other news that I don't think the market has discounted yet is that Omicron is probably a blessing. Dr. Campbell believes that Omicron is what's going to end the pandemic. Now, remember, these guys like Chris Martinson and John Campbell, these are the same people that were ridiculed as fearmongers and alarmists when they said we had a really serious problem back in January of 2020. Now, the guys who got it right the first time are consistently saying, look, we think Omicron is going to end this pandemic because it's going to become an endemic where the Omicron strain is with us forever. It's a new form form of common cold, and it will effectively create the immunity that's needed to get rid of all of those more dangerous earlier strains of this virus. That's not being priced in at all. And I think when the market has that aha moment and realizes, first, it's going to be probably uglier than people think, then we're going to get the news that, hey, this really is amazingly good news. It's going to end the pandemic. Everything's going to be better. Now, those are predictions that people are making. Obviously, nothing is 100%. We deal in probabilities in this business. But all of the data that I'm seeing says most likely Omicron is a really good thing. It's just going to be ugly for a little while. And I don't think the market is discounting how ugly it's going to get for a little while. But more importantly, I don't think it's discounting how much better it's going to get and how quickly it's going to get better after that.
Eric, that's a fascinating take. But don't you think that if it is that short and it is only a matter of a few weeks, that the market's going to see through it?
Well, Kevin, that's a fantastic point. And the short answer is, I don't know the answer, because I think the market is looking through it exactly as you say, because it's only a few weeks. The thing is, I don't think most people are ready for what's coming in terms of disruptions and things not working. You try to call American Airlines to change your flight, you get a recording that says, we'll be happy to answer your call sometime between 2 hours, 45 minutes and 11 hours from now. That's literally what it said to me yesterday afternoon. That kind of thing is going to get worse for the next several weeks, and it's probably going to cause some people to freak out and think, oh my gosh, the sky is falling. Omicron is, you know, taking over the world. Everybody's getting it. This is the end. It's not the end. It's the end of the pandemic is what it is. But it's going to be ugly for a little while with a lot of overwhelmed medical facilities and probably a lot of scared people.
Some great insights. Okay, so let's jump into the markets. Let's start with this S&P 500. What do you see happening there?
Well, Kevin, I'm the first to admit that I don't know what to make of this stock market, because it seems like they've been buying the dip, but you know, the Fed is eventually going to have to follow through with their promises and the taper their asset purchases and maybe even reduce their balance sheet. Hard to see how we get through that without some kind of significant market correction, but so far it seems like nobody's too worried about it. We're not having another taper tantrum, at least not yet.
One of the interesting things about that, though, Eric, is the fact that, yes, they are buying the dip in the S&P 500, but the rotation within the market has been absolutely huge. We have all of the tech stocks going offered, and yet we have things like banks, insurance, real economy stocks flying the other way.
You're the macro tourist, Kevin. Give us the interpretation of what that sector rotation means and what it portends for the market.
Well,
I'll take credit for it as if I said it.
Well, I do think it started, and I do think that where this rotation is upon us. And the real question that investors should be asking themselves is, if this rotation continues, can it happen in a way that allows the market to go sideways or maybe down a little without a real accident out there? And that's the question that I don't have an answer to. All right, let's talk about some more macro indicators out there. The U.S. dollar, what do you see on that horizon?
Well, we gave up the 96 plateau that was holding until this week. The next couple of support levels that I see are 94 spot 46 and 93 spot 20. But really, the big support level is all the way down at 89. We're in this consolidation range that bottoms out at 89. Been there for a couple of years. And I think what's going on, I think the reason it's taken so long that we've been stuck in this range is because it's a really complicated picture to decode monetary policy and what monetary policy is going to change to before it actually takes effect, and figure out where all of this stuff is headed. So I don't think the market has figured it out yet, and I think we're probably going to continue to consolidate in this range. And honestly, I don't have any view on whether we go up or down or sideways inside the range, but I think we're going to be stuck in this range for quite a while.
I saw a couple of interesting research reports this week, Eric, that highlighted the previous Fed tightening cycles. And if you look at it, the U.S. dollar actually tops at the moment of the first hike, and then proceeds to sell off, which is very contrary to what most people believe. And I'm just wondering if that's what we're experiencing. We're at that point where the Fed is about to raise rates and the dollar is looking like it wants to go higher, but then at the same time, it's about to set the stage for a decline. All right, let's go to the next commodity, something near and dear to your heart and something that we all tune into here. You talk about crude oil. What do you see there?
Kevin, let's start with this week's inventory. Crude oil drawing down 4.6 million barrels nationally, and Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 2.5 million barrels. Now, That would normally cause me to express a little bit of concern because we was really excited about that series of builds in Cushing. They were very much needed, and some people have been anticipating that there could be a reversal where Cushing starts to draw back down and risk getting to dangerously low levels where we're right at the operational limits of Cushing's ability to service the market. The reason I'm not worried too much about that this week is remember that the Keystone pipeline was offline for more than a day. So at least 590,000 barrels didn't get delivered because of the Keystone pipeline outage, probably quite a bit more than that by the time they're done getting it back online. And I don't know if they ran it at reduced capacity initially and so forth. Keystone is definitely contributing to that, but I'll be watching the Cushing numbers in coming weeks. Meanwhile, that crude oil drawdown was offset by a really big build in gasoline. 8 million barrels. Distillates also building 2.5 million barrels. So those big finished product builds more than offset crude oil's drawdown. U.S. production ticked down 100,000 barrels back down to 11.7 million barrels. Time spreads were implying that Cushing going dry fears had resumed. We saw time spreads really starting to blow up right after the news came out about the Keystone pipeline going offline. They seem just this afternoon, just in the last couple hours as we started recording, they're finally starting to come back down. I don't know if we're going to see them sell all the way back off, if that fear has come out of the market. We'll see what next week brings. But at least for the moment, it seems like the Cushing running dry fears have dropped out of the market. I do think that there is a chance that Omicron hiccups, that would be more of those things that we talked about earlier, like United Airlines, you know, not being able to service their customers and businesses having to shut down because there's not enough employees and everybody's out sick and the pharmacies are overloaded and they run out of prescriptions and all those things that are likely to happen, screwing up the economy. I wouldn't be surprised if that gives us a buying opportunity to buy a dip in the oil market. It's not going to be back down to 62 or anything close to it. I'd be happy to get mid-70s again in order to add to my long positions. It's also a narrative that our good friend Ola Hansen shared in a research note just today. He's saying that spare capacity of some of the OPEC producers is in question. In other words, when OPEC increased production because they've got all this spare capacity, which you've got to remember, spare capacity is OPEC's power. That's what gives them the ability to change oil prices by adjusting the amount of oil that's produced. It seems that some of the OPEC members were unable to increase production to meet their new limits. So on one hand, their public-facing political side says, oh, we have the ability because we're OPEC to do anything we want. When they actually take a policy action and they're unable to implement that policy action because some of their members don't have as much spare capacity as they claim to have, that really just sets off a light bulb in my mind. First of all, I don't know whether Ola's analysis is correct or not. He's a very smart guy, so I'm assuming that it probably is. But something I've been predicting for almost a decade now, Kevin, is I don't know when we get to the point where the myth of OPEC spare capacity, OPEC would like us to believe they've got lots and lots of spare capacity and therefore lots and lots of pricing power to control the market. I've always said a day is coming, I have no idea when we wake up and find out, oops, OPEC Plus doesn't really have as much spare capacity as they claimed. They're pedaling as fast as they can, and we don't have enough production to meet demand. That's very much at odds with consensus that thinks that declining demand because of electric vehicles will make this whole oil problem go away. I think the final years of the age of oil is going to be punctuated by extremely high prices, and that happens when OPEC runs out of spare capacity and we haven't invested in new producing resources. We've got the ingredients setting that up. I don't know if it happens this year, next year, or 5 years from now, but I believe that moment is coming where OPEC spare capacity is exposed as a myth.
The twilight in the desert scenario will finally play out.
And you know, as much as people ridicule that guy for that book, he really was right. He was just way early, and he didn't anticipate a mountain of easy money that was going to, you know, right. Shale was made possible by easy money from the Fed. If we didn't have the easy money, we wouldn't have had the shale revolution. So I forgot the gentleman's name who wrote Twilight in the Desert, but you know, he really did have the right idea. He just was a couple decades earlier than it turned out to happen.
Moving on to gold, do you foresee any respite for long-suffering gold bulls like myself?
Kevin, how many times has it been, and you only have to go back 2 weeks to find an example, where I said on Macro Voices, okay, guys, gold chart's finally looking good. We've got a breakout. We're put all the moving averages behind us. That's all the moving averages are below the price action. We got a solid green candle that's completely above all those moving averages. Everything's looking great. And then the next day after I say that on Macro Voices, the market takes a plunge. Well, this week it happened a day early, so the plunge was this morning. We got back down to the five-day moving average, but bouncing nicely off of it. So there's still room to say, okay, this still looks pretty good finally, but how many false alarms have we had? 1830 is the level we need to get above first, and then 1880 is really the test in my mind. When we get a breakout above 1880 and it stays there for a week, that tells me that the gold bull market that everybody's been waiting for is actually on. Until then, I don't know. It seems to me like we've got a lot of false breakouts, and until I really see some legs to one, I'm not going to trust it.
Well, I won't jinx it by talking about it too much. Let's move on to fixed income. The 10-year, what do you see there?
You know, Kevin, the best I can say, to be completely honest here, is I think it's time to watch closely. I have no idea what's going to happen, but we are getting to 1.75 on the 10-year as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. That's kind of where the red line in the sand has been in terms of where people start to freak out and say, oh my gosh, the beginning of the bond market crash is upon us. Now, I know you wrote a very interesting article that Bloomberg just picked up. I want to go into more detail on that, so let's save that for the postgame segment. We'll talk more about the bond market structurally, where it fits into the financial system, whether it still makes sense for it to fit into the financial system, and a whole bunch more. That's coming up in the postgame segment after the feature interview.
This week's feature interview guest is Darius Dale. Why did we get him back on the show?
Well, Darius is a super smart guy, but particularly last time we had him on, he made a call that turned out to be spot on. He said, look, I'm with you on secular inflation, but I feel like my indicators are telling me we're going to see a pause in the reflation trade. It's going to pull back, and then it'll come back, but there's going to be a pause, a pullback first. He nailed that pullback call, so I wanted to get him back and say, you still think it's pulling back, or are we going back to inflation again? So I wanted to get an update on that and also just a general perspective. It's been a while since we had him on the show, and I think you're going to love this interview.
Eric's interview with Darius Dale is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you listen to just one podcast per week, stick with Macro Voices. But if you can listen to two, tune into Smarter Markets by Abaxx Technologies. Join us for the remainder of January as we kick off the new year with our series, What Are Smarter Markets?, hosted by Grant Williams and featuring Jeff Curry, head of commodities research for Goldman Sachs. Future episodes will feature Abaxx founder and CEO Josh Crum, as well as yours truly, Eric Townsend. Smarter Markets brings you the entrepreneurs, icons, and executives of commodities, capital markets, and technology to rant on the inadequacies of our systems and riff on ideas for how to improve them. Our weekly episodes explore how technology can be leveraged to redesign and improve markets to meet society's biggest challenges, including energy transition. Join the conversation on Twitter at @smarter_markets.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. Darius has prepared an outstanding chart deck to accompany this week's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button above Darius's photo that says looking for the downloads. I want to let our listeners know this particular slide deck is a lot longer than we're going to have time to cover in the podcast. We're doing this intentionally because there's so much value that is contained in this particular slide deck, which I wanted our listeners to see, even though we won't have time to cover all the slides in the podcast. Now, Darius works from a systematic approach to macro investing, where he tracks what growth is doing, what inflation is doing, and he kind of makes a grid that says, okay, when inflation's going up and growth is going down, okay, these circumstances are going to exist. So there's four different possibilities there. Darius, most of our Macro Voices listeners already know your system, but for the benefit of newcomers, what's the best place to learn about the basics of that system before we dive into the meat of it?
Yeah, absolutely, Eric. I appreciate you guys having me back on. Happy New Year and all that stuff, even though Larry David tells us we can't say this past the 7th. I'm violating the rules here. But in terms of finding the that presentation, we put that together on our YouTube channel. We'll make sure the link is included in this this week's research roundup.
Fantastic. Now, the last time that we had you on talking about not how the process works, but applying the process, you told us, look, you believe that we're going to see secular inflation over the next several years. But you put in a really big caveat. You said, look, the signals are telling me we're going to go the opposite direction, a little bit of a pullback before that inflation trend resumes. How did that call work out? And are you still on the deflation call or have you flipped back to an inflationary outlook?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would start with maybe slide 26 is probably the first place to answer that question. So we did get the pullback in terms of unwinding the prior reflation regime. We obviously saw some pretty material drawdowns in a lot of physical commodities and a lot of digital commodities throughout the summer months. But then we actually had a sort of bounce in reflation as the world really pulled out of Delta. And now we're actually having a secondary bounce in reflation as the world is really sort of pricing in this dynamic whereby Omicron crowds out more dangerous variants of COVID and effectively ends the pandemic. This is something obviously you've been talking about in your show for quite some time. Ultimately, we see this sort of kind of tertiary reflation bounce fading into a sea of deflation that we show on slide 10 that we ultimately think asset markets will be forced to move to price in a few months.
Darius, I want to go back to something you just said about Omicron crowding out the other strains. Because when I go back to page 3 of your deck, you say here specifically, Omicron crowding out the more virulent strains and effectively ending the pandemic phase of the COVID-19 crisis. Darius, I know you understand this subject very well, and I am in agreement with you, but I've also learned from the feedback I've gotten on Twitter and email in response to our podcast coverage of this subject that a lot of people are not following it. What they're saying is, wait a minute, you're saying that Omicron, because it's so transmissive, is going to crowd out the prior strains. Well, what if the next strain that comes after Omicron, if we don't run out of Greek letters first, that is, what if the next strain is much more dangerous than Omicron and even more transmissive and it crowds out Omicron? What's to stop that from happening? Why wouldn't that be the next thing? Please help our listeners understand this.
Indeed. So I'll first apply the quick boilerplate language that, hey, I'm obviously not an epidemiologist. It's not something I've studied, but certainly from listening to smart folks like you and Dr. Chris Martinson and even my former colleague, Neil Howe, at the onset of the pandemic, you know, this was always going to be the likely phase or sort of the likely progression of how this would play out, which is we're going to see increasingly less virulence from subsequent variants because that's what viruses do. They want to stay alive. They want to keep the host alive so that the virus can reproduce and find new hosts. If the virus is too deadly, then obviously that process is obviously culminated early. So we're going to continue to see less, more and more mild variants. And ultimately, that's why we believe the pandemic phase is sort of ending in the near term.
Darius, something I noticed in the feedback I got on Twitter and email is I think there's a key concept that people are missing, which is they're saying, well, wait a minute, you know, Omicron, the next variant that could come after Omicron might be even more transmissive. Really think about this like a competition, like prize fighters. Omicron has an R-naught of 6.0, or at least it's estimated at that. There's almost nothing except maybe measles that's more transmissible and more contagious than Omicron. People are saying, well, but look, having Delta didn't save you from getting Omicron, so having Omicron is not going to save you from getting whatever comes next. The point they're missing is they're looking at the wrong data. The growth of Omicron has completely defeated the growth of Delta. The case counts are showing that Delta is less than 3% of new cases now because Omicron has crowded it out. What it would take to crowd Omicron out is something much more transmissible than Omicron. For something to become more transmissible to Omicron while it's killing a substantial percentage of the hosts that it's in is almost impossible. Now, I don't know this science any better than you do, but everything I'm reading jibes with what you're saying, Darius, and what I've just described, which is you don't want to look at whether or not getting Delta saved you from getting Omicron. You want to look at whether the breakout of Omicron ended the breakout of Delta, which it very clearly has. And then I'm going on faith from there that what the epidemiologists and experts tell us is that for something to be more contagious than Omicron and much more deadly is almost impossible, not completely impossible, but profoundly unlikely. Anything else that you want to add before we move on from this subject? Because I think it's a really important one.
No, the one thing, the final thing I'd add on this entire discussion topic goes back to where we started, which is the fact that your feedback loop in terms of Twitter, your inbox, and et cetera, there's still this large contingent of investors out there that don't necessarily buy into what you and I are discussing and agreeing upon right now, tells me that this sort of nascent reflation regime that has sort of perked its head up here in the recent weeks has legs. I mean, it certainly could have legs for a few months until we ultimately get into the market having to price in the cyclical decelerations and growth and inflation.
Well, now I want to hit you with the hardest question, or what I think is the hardest question. Let's suppose that you and I have this exactly right, and that what's about to happen is that Omicron is going to basically turn the COVID crisis into a common cold crisis. Everybody's going to get it. The Omicron wave is going to be the one that just about everybody you know got that darn thing. But most people didn't get very sick over it. It becomes endemic. It's a new form of common cold. It's a real nuisance for society forever. But the pandemic phase is over. And let's suppose that that means that we're going to return to rapid growth of the global economy. We're going to get rid of all of the travel restrictions and lockdowns and so forth and reopen everything. Okay, simple question, but I would argue incredibly difficult answer. Is that good or bad for the stock market that we're coming out of this horrible, horrible global pandemic crisis and into good times? And the reason I ask that question, Darius, is look at what happened in the other direction. Everybody assumed it was going to be horrible news for the stock market, but then we figured out that actually with all the stimulus the government throws in, it was good news that we were having a global pandemic, at least in terms of asset prices. So does that mean that the recovery is bad news for asset prices?
Yeah, I tend to think that the sequence of events really does matter. So if you start on slide 28 and sort of look at what we call our cross-asset correction risk indicator, I won't get into sort of how it's calculated. You guys can come check out our site on that. But the reality is we sort of gotten to a place where investor consensus was sort of peak fearful kind of heading into the middle of, you know, December. And the unwind of that sort of, you know, consensus fear has perpetuated the reemergence of a reflation regime, which in our opinion is being predicated on this sort of Omicron ending the pandemic dynamic. And so to the extent that investors, you know, sort of have to re-lever up and kind of chase that, that should perpetuate a positive asset market response, you know, kind of into throughout Q1 and maybe even as late as the early part of Q2. But to answer your question, we would argue that the ending the pandemic phase of the economy is coming at precisely the wrong time as it relates to asset markets and financial conditions, because you're talking about a sort of a fiscal and monetary policy tightening or dual contraction, if you will, not just in the U.S. economy, but this is a pretty broad base throughout the global economy if you look at most parts of the developed and emerging world. And the reality is it's very unlikely we meet consensus growth expectations in that process. And that's certainly something I like to unpack.
Okay, let's talk this through then, because it seems to me that where we're headed is we're going to see this reflation where there's a recovery in the economy. At some point, that causes governments to say it's time for us to withdraw stimulus completely. And as soon as they do that, markets start to panic and governments say, oh boy, we started a fire we can't put out. We got to keep at least some of this stimulus going in order to not crash the market. Is that the right way to think about what's coming, and how do we know which phase we're in?
No, I think that's to be honest and frank, I think that's precisely the wrong way to think about what's coming. In our opinion, the Fed is not only behind the curve, but increasingly falling behind the curve. You know, in our opinion, the last two labor market reports, you know, the November jobs report and the December jobs report, really sort of sent a signal from our perspective to asset markets that the labor market was much further along than really the Fed has acknowledged that it realizes. Kind of looking through kind of a few slides on that, just starting with slide 99, just looking at labor supply, it's had a pretty material recovery if you think about the improvement in the employment to population ratio and the female labor force participation rate. And, you know, if it's like, you look at slide 100, the kind of improvement in the total number of people who are unemployed and the total number of people in the labor force both really accelerated markedly post the expiration of the enhanced unemployment insurance. And really the key takeaway of what I'm saying here is on slides 101 and 102. If you sort of parse the labor market out by education cohort, or in slide 102, if you parse it out by ethnic cohort, you're seeing some really, really material step function increases and improvement in the sort of cohorts that are most impacted by the pandemic, whether it be those without a high school diploma, those with a high school diploma, you know, Hispanic workers or African-American workers. And so that leads me to where we are on slide 103, which is if you sort of take our model's forecast at face value, and our model's forecast for core PCE are a little bit more sticky than the consensus forecast for core PCE, it's very likely, and we've been arguing this since early December, it's very likely that the Fed has to hike four times in 2022. And more importantly, now that they've interjected this sort of quantitative tightening metric into the equation, it's very likely we see even more policy tightness than investor consensus expects at the current juncture. And again, this is a function of the labor market being extremely robust and tight. Jumping back a few slides on slide 98, where we show employment cost index relative to the quit rates in the JOLTS data, you know, the Fed is moving. The Fed was right in terms of, you know, the tradable goods inflation being transitory. And we're already seeing that if you look at the NFIB survey data, the consumer confidence survey data, if you look at the ISM, so both manufacturing and non-manufacturing, the percentage of respondents reporting slower supplier delivery times, those are crashing in both surveys now. So that they were right on that call. But what they're missing is the wage pressure that's building up in the economy. And so ultimately, to answer your question, Eric, sorry about the long-winded answer, slide 104 is kind of all you really need to know, which is, the blue line just shows we're cresting in the global growth cycle, and the black line shows kind of the relationship between high beta stocks relative to low beta stocks, and the red line shows the relationship between Bitcoin and treasury bond prices. And as you've seen the last few cycles, and I can pull this chart back as far back as we get the data, you know, whenever we roll off the peak in the global growth cycle, and the U.S. is a real key contributor to that at the current juncture, or at least in the few months they will be, it's been, you know, sort of, for lack of a better word, it's been a lot of pain. There's been a ton of pain in high beta risk assets and commodities in particular, whenever the global growth cycle peaks and rolls, as we are projecting it will, sort of really starting in earnest in Q2.
Okay, Darius, so it sounds like what you're saying is, in your view, the Fed is late to tighten and has lots of tightening that it needs to do in order to catch up. If that's your view, does that mean you expect the Fed to actually do those things, or you just think they should? And regardless of what that answer is, tell us kind of how you see this playing out. Let's assume that you and I approximately have this right, that either Omicron ends the pandemic or at least ends the pandemic phase to where we still have a COVID problem, but it's not shutting down the economy anymore. If it goes in that direction, as you and I think it will, talk us through how this plays out.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's our view that the Fed is very serious about this sort of policy tightening dynamic. If anything, you know, it's really just a function of their, you go back to August of 2020, all we're seeing is really just the other side of their policy framework adjustment. They've adopted a sort of, you know, average inflation targeting framework to allow for, you know, sort of the improvement allow for their maximum inclusive, the revised maximum inclusive employment mandate to be accomplished. And now, not only are we accomplishing it, we're accomplishing it much, much sooner than I think anyone at the Federal Reserve, or quite frankly, any of us investors would have thought, you know, going back to that August of 2020 timeframe. And so to answer your question, I do believe they're very much in line to see a decent amount of tightening, you know, because again, if you think about where we're coming from, the starting point is pretty astronomical. If you think about kind of where inflation is relative to its longer term time series, we show that on slide 8. Now we show slide 8 on terms of headline CPI, but I think a more kind of important inflation metric would be on slide 92, which is median CPI. Median CPI on a SAR basis is coming off its all-time high rate in the month of November. And the reality is, you know, even though it's ticked down in the most recent month, the reality is it's still extremely elevated relative to the longer term time series. So there's a tremendous amount of inflation pressure brewing in the economy. And so, you know, to answer your question, I do believe that once they get going, and to be frank, I believe they've already kind of gotten going in terms of, you know, doubling the pace of tapering and really putting March out there as a legitimate policy tightening, you know, likelihood, and also introducing quantitative tightening into the mix. I wouldn't necessarily say they're on a set it and forget it path like they were in 2018. But I do believe the Fed put is significantly lower than we've, you know, kind of become accustomed to as investors, because it's very unlikely that the Fed will have any data, particularly coming out of the labor market, for at least a year, if not more, to allow them to sort of pivot back in a direction that's dovish.
Let's try to reconcile what you're saying with what the stock market is doing. Because back in 2013, we had this big taper tantrum where the market said, look, if the Fed's really serious and they're actually going to taper their asset purchases and they're going to, you know, start maybe even shrinking their balance sheet, that has to be bad for the stock market. So everybody panicked. But the learning experience from 2013 was, well, yeah, the Fed says they're going to do this stuff until the market starts to collapse and then they change their mind. And next time we'll just ignore it and look through it. And it feels to me like that's what's been going on is there's lots of reasons. There's been plenty of warning from the Fed that they're getting ready to taper. Nobody seems to sweat it. Asset prices just keep melting up. So do you see this as there's an awakening moment where all of a sudden we have a market crash because everybody realizes the Fed was serious? Or does the Fed turn unserious on us like they did last time?
Yeah, I think to answer your question, I think it starts on slides 94 and sort of ends on slide 95. Starting with slide 94, I do believe a market crash in 2022 is a reasonably probable scenario. And the reason I say it's a reasonably probable scenario, just sort of looking at kind of attacking the question twofold. One, here on slide 94, we show the real S&P 500 earnings yield. You know, this is something we've had in the deck for quite a while now, which is, hey, you look every time the S&P 500 earnings yield, i.e. the stock market's valuation has gotten so pricey relative to inflation dynamics, you typically what happens is the Fed has to respond to that on a lag and really sort of perpetuate a material tightening financial conditions. You know, the back test on the real earnings yield going negative, you know, in the last sort of 50, 60 years has an end size of 6. And there's been two 10% corrections from that threshold breaching. There's been one 20% correction from that threshold breaching. And there have been three 50% corrections from that threshold breaching. So obviously the median is you know, a lot closer to 20 than it is to down 5, as we've become accustomed to really since kind of late 2020, early 2021. Second chart is on slide 95. And this sort of takes me back to the point you made with respect to 2013 and that taper tantrum. You know, the reality is, and what I'm showing in the chart, the slide on slide 95 here, is how we calculate net liquidity, which is simply the Fed's balance sheet minus the Treasury general account, because obviously those two levers have a pretty outsized influence on either tightening or easing financial conditions. And so what we found is that whenever the slope of this line, the blue line, which is the net liquidity line, as we calculate it, whenever that slope flattens out, you typically have some pretty material sort of drawdowns in the stock market, you know, kind of isolating 2010 as a good example. You know, we had 16% drawdown then. 2011 would be a good example, 20% drawdown then. 2012, I think we had a couple of 10% drawdowns with that flattening. Obviously, you can barely see the taper tantrum on the chart here on slide 2013. And part of the reason for that is that we had a pretty massive shift higher in net liquidity provision out of the Federal Reserve. And that really didn't stop until you got into sort of middle of 2015. And that's when we saw the China deval really have material market impact. But we would argue this is more of a bigger factor. The risk was already there. The China deval, if anything, really just amplified the risk and sort of allowed the market to correct. You had another one, a 15, 16% decline at the start of 2016. And then obviously 10% decline in early 2018, 20% decline in late 2018. And then lastly, they stopped fixing the repo market in early 2020, which is precisely the wrong time to stop doing that. We obviously saw a 35% decline. So that was a long-winded way of saying, hey, whenever the blue line in this chart flattens out, as we expect it to do, irrespective of QT, and QT will only make that matter worse, we're going to come into some pretty bumpy times. So investors should be really thinking about managing a tremendous amount of risk kind of starting in early Q2 and potentially persisting throughout the end of the year.
Now, talk to me a little more about this blue line on page 95, because it's obscured a bit by the red line and it's a little hard to read. But it looks to me, if I kind of squint and I can talk myself into the idea that maybe it's peaking out and starting to reverse. Normally, I would say that little blip is not big enough to really tell me it's topping out. It's not a big enough blip. But if I put the rest of the story behind it, it sounds like maybe that blue line really is topping out. Is that your view?
Yeah, that is absolutely our view. I mean, our view is that, you know, the blue line is slowly approaching its sort of crescendo as a function of the sort of wind down and QE. Don't forget, the Fed is still buying bonds and adding liquidity to the system through, you know, sort of through February. And so, you know, we have at least another month of them sort of, you know, accumulating assets and perpetuating that. But the reality is, you know, once we get, now that we are on the other side of sort of the budget deficit being passed, which is on slide 96, you know, you look at the Treasury general account, that balance is now starting to go up. And that's obviously a negative value or sort of has a negative influence on the blue line going back to slide 95. And so, you know, the reality is if quantitative tightening gets introduced into the mix, which again, we think that's sort of a, you know, at the earliest, maybe a late Q2 or early Q3 dynamic, We sort of in line with Goldman on that one. If that does get introduced into the mix at the same time the Treasury General account balance is continuing to tick up, you're going to start to see a more material decline in the blue line. But the reality is I don't think you need to see a decline in the blue line. I think the confluence of a sort of faster than expected growth slowdown, the confluence of a cyclical deceleration in inflation, but particularly remaining sticky in some certain pockets of the market like shelter CPI and wages, and also sort of the starting point of asset market valuations, that those three factors alone could coincide and perpetuate a 20% decline in something like the S&P 500, which obviously will be much worse in higher beta risk assets.
Now, this is just my personal view, but it seems to me like what's most important in that scenario where you're seeing, let's say, a 20% correction in asset markets, it's going to be the posturing and the messaging from the Fed. Because if they're saying, look it, we're not in the business of bailing out markets and we mean it, even at 20% down, we still mean it. We're not in the business of bailing out the stock market. I think that could lead to a collapse of confidence or of complacency, rather, that could really, really, you know, take us down to 40% really quickly. On the other hand, if the Fed starts to cave again and say, oh, well, you know, it's 20% down, maybe we're going to change our story and be a little more accommodative, I think that just sets up the next generation of moral hazard, if you will. How do you see this going down? Is this the time when the Fed finally is going to put their foot down and say they mean it?
Yeah, no, I do believe this is the time where the Fed has to put their foot down, because I think one thing that is different in this cycle, that is very different and unique relative to the most recent, you know, set of iterations on the inflation and labor market front, which is we actually have legitimate wage pressures. Going back to slide 98, we have an all-time high in the quits rate. And you just go to slide 99, the sort of the labor force participation rate for prime working age individuals, that's the middle chart in those three panels, you know, hasn't improved at all in the last sort of 6 months. And the reality is we've seen a structural reduction in the total available labor supply, not just domestically, but also internationally. And that's obviously feeding back into the wage pressures that are ultimately sort of, you know, really amplifying a lot of the sort of tradable goods inflation that we're seeing from supply chain disruption. And so the reality is, if you go back to slide 103, it's like, hey, where will inflation be relative to their targets, relative to the mandate, and relative to their stated objectives at various intervals throughout 2022? Because I think 2022 is the real big issue as it relates to financial markets. I don't think the market cares about, you know, the Fed hiking rates three or four times in 2023. To me, the financial market risk is all concentrated in this 2022 timeframe. And the reason I say that, not to be cute with the calendar, but the reality is we have some pretty, I think funky would be the best word to use to describe some of the growth dynamics in the economy that could actually come home to roost in a material way to the downside for asset markets, just as the Fed is sort of kind of locking itself, if you will, by the data. Again, this is a data-dependent Fed. The data are locking the Fed into a very tight policy setting. And so if you don't mind, I'm happy to unpack those.
Darius, unpack away.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, let's start with slide 80. We're just sort of showing the yield curve flattening. Obviously, we've seen a cyclical bounce in the sort of the flattening of the yield curve. And I do believe that it has duration through however long this reflation regime we're currently in is likely to last and to persist. But the reality is ultimately, we're just going to make a lower high on all these yield curves. And part of the reason I think we're making lower highs in yield curve terms starts with 81 and 82, which is, you know, if you think about the income that consumers are actually receiving, you know, from the labor market and, you know, ex-government transfers, you know, we're actually contracting at a -3% annualized pace in the most recent month. That was the November PCE data. And you actually saw that have a pretty material impact on consumer spending. That's on slide 82. The third panel there shows the seasonally adjusted annualized rate of consumer spending basically grind to a halt in November. Now, clearly, there was some pull forward in terms of demand in the month of October. But again, citing the prior chart, you know, it wasn't just demand. It was very clearly that income growth on a real basis, ex-government transfers, is actually contracting at a pretty material rate. And so that brings me to my next series of slides, which I think are important for investors to spend some time on, which are, you know, starting with 83. You know, we show the delta between the goods consumption line. Obviously, we've been over consuming goods in this pandemic relative to consumer services. And there's this expectation in the market that service consumption, once the pandemic is over, is going to come and be a real big panacea in terms of supporting growth. And I don't disagree with that. I think that's a very reasonable assumption. The problem is we're over consuming goods to a degree that sort of dwarfs the size of the under consumption in services. And that actually nets out to a negative number. And that's important if you think about slide 84, which is, you know, Bloomberg consensus, and this is, goes back to the point of market risk. Bloomberg consensus is expecting above trend growth, meaningfully above trend growth in 2022. In fact, that 3.9 estimate is 170 basis points north of the five-year trend line through 2019, right? Like if you think about that, okay, what is Bloomberg consensus looking at in the context of a consumer spending, a consumer that's already starting to stall out in late Q4 of 2021? Well, the reality is there's obviously the kind of the consensus view is, hey, well, there's a lot of excess savings in terms of our calculations on, you know, the amount of checkable deposits and currency assets households hold is roughly about $2.6 trillion in excess savings. But then you think about the excess budget deficits the U.S. government has sort of piled on. It's really supported growth in the last couple of years. Our math on that is around $2.3 trillion in excess budget deficits relative to the kind of the legislation associated with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is, you know, effectively law, which is now the law governing the land in the absence of the Build Back Better agenda, which we always thought had a really low percentage chance of passing, particularly once we saw that October inflation reading. And so the kind of the key takeaway on all this is, if you assume the kind of the rise on slide 86 here, if you assume the rise in the net worth of the bottom 50% of households by wealth distribution is all cash, which obviously it's not. There's some stocks, there's some crypto, there's, you know, housing assets, there's all this other stuff. But if you assume it's all cash waiting to be spent into the economy, it's, you know, just shy of $700 or $800 billion. Well, that $800 billion is roughly in line with the total amount of inflation households are expected to experience in the year 2022. So you kind of the bottom half of the income and wealth distribution in the U.S. economy has already been priced out of the economy, is what we're effectively saying. And so kind of taking it back to slide 84, you know, those growth expectations are pretty materially elevated relative to kind of where trend growth is in the U.S. economy. And so in our opinion, the balance of risk is very much skewed to the downside with respect to growth. And the reason I bring that up is because we have a Federal Reserve that won't have any data for a really long period of time that will data from the labor market and labor data from the sort of inflation readings that'll tell it to back off, that'll tell it that it's tightened financial conditions too much. And that's a real big problem if you go back to slide 104 in terms of where we are in the market cycle.
Darius, we've been talking about a lot of your cyclical views. I want to talk bigger picture, longer term secular views. This whole inflation debate, you and I talked about this last time we had you on the program, and you said you really think we are headed towards secular inflation. But I don't think we really quantified what that means. And what I'm finding as I talk to a lot of people is different people have very different ideas of how much inflation is a lot of inflation. Some people are saying, no, we're not going to get nearly as much as the 1970s. It's only going to be 10 or 12%. Other people are saying we're going to get huge inflation of 3 or 4%. So it really depends on your perspective. What are we talking about in terms of what's coming for this secular inflation that you and I see ahead? Is it bigger than 1970s or is it much smaller than the 1970s?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And you said a word that really struck a chord with me in a very positive way, which is quantifying. I mean, most investors that are familiar with me and familiar with my work over the last sort of 12, 13, 14 years, you know, goes back to, you know, kind of my time at my prior shop, HedgeEye, you know, developing, you know, their regime-based economic and asset allocation system called the Quads, and ultimately sort of developing what we call our grids here at 42 Macro, which is quantify everything that can be quantified, you know, reduce the sort of, you know, narrow the range of probable outcomes so that we can make better investment decisions as investors. And so, you know, as it relates to sort of this secular inflation narrative, which I, you know, emphasis on the word narrative, because that's what I see from a lot of investors, which is inflation is going to be much higher. Therefore, you must do this from an asset allocation perspective. And I don't necessarily disagree with the kind of premise of that, but I do think it's important to sort of put some bands around that and ultimately reduce the size and kind of the frequency of the observations on the tail so that we can actually be in the right assets and at the right particular moments in time to take advantage of that theme, of that view. And so starting with slide 57, this 57 and 58 are two of the four sort of secular drivers of economic risk in our framework. And you know, starting with slide 57, that's politics. And how we quantify political risk is through the lens of the Gini coefficient, which we show on the x-axis, and the y-axis shows the prime working age employment to population ratio. And very clearly, if you, as you look at where the United States sort of dot is on the scatter plot, it's very clearly that we're much more akin from a political risk perspective to our emerging market counterparts as we are than we are with respect to our developed market counterparts in Europe and Japan, and obviously in Canada and places of that nature. So, you know, that in our opinion is on slide 58. That's why the U.S. responded so aggressively to the COVID-19 pandemic. There's a sort of zeitgeist of inequality and frustration out there among the U.S. voter base that has really catalyzed kind of a sea change left, a jump condition left among both parties with respect to their willingness to sort of, you know, blow holes in the budget deficit in order to appease the various sort of cohorts in their voter bases. That takes me to slide 59. And so we can spend a decent amount of time on here in this slide and the subsequent slides kind of going through, you know, 59 all the way through kind of 77, really summarize our longer term views on inflation. But, you know, the key takeaway here is that, you know, we've built a dynamic factor model that takes into account all of the major drivers of inflation, both to the up and down over the last few decades. And ultimately, our math on in terms of that model is suggesting that the stationary mean of CPI of inflation time series in the U.S. economy has transposed itself around 60 to 100 basis points higher. That's somewhere around sort of 40 to 70 basis points for PCE. And that has a material impact as it relates to your asset allocation. That has a material impact as it relates to, you know, sort of, you know, your longer term sort of portfolio construction within the equity and credit markets as well. But the key takeaway is that we're not headed for runaway inflation. Now, if you think about kind of looking towards the bottom of this table, you know, the stationary mean of CPI using headline CPI is kind of the easiest sort of metric to observe. It was only 1.8% in the prior decade. Our model was, you know, in terms of where all the factors are currently ranking now, we delta adjust the factors and weight them relative to their impact with respect to predicting inflation. And the reality is we're talking about inflation, really the stationary mean, i.e. the level with which inflation oscillates around. We're talking about a stationary mean of somewhere around 2.4 to 2.8% as it relates to the latest data. And this is taking into account all the different changes of things that have happened in the pandemic. If you look at, you know, kind of just quickly going through the slide 60, automation has come down a little bit. Consumer demand has come down or come up slightly a bit. Demographics have gotten more disinflationary in 62, 63. The Fed reaction function has gotten much more inflationary. Slide 64, the fiscal balance has gotten inflationary. Slide 65, globalization has actually gotten inflationary. A lot of people just say globalization as a longer term factor in terms of perpetuating disinflation. But the reality is we've been moving in the wrong direction on that scorecard for almost a decade now. And in fact, it's actually gotten more inflationary in terms of the lack of the reduction in globalization in terms of how we calculate it through the imports of goods and services as a percent of GDP. On slide 66, household formation is materially higher. It's inflationary. 67, income inequality is materially higher. That's disinflationary. Slide 68, money supply is obviously much more inflationary, but money velocity on 69 is actually quite disinflationary. All-time lows in money velocity. Slide 70, monopsony power, that's disinflationary. We have much more concentration in market cap and share of income, both domestically and globally, in the larger sectors of the economy, larger firms relative to smaller firms. Slide 70, public debt, that's obviously extremely inflationary. That's one of the most commonly cited metrics in terms of why we are likely to have an inflation problem or inflation accident over the next few years. Slide 72, technology has gotten significantly more disinflationary. If you look at sort of our proxy for that is the market cap of the NASDAQ 100 relative to the Russell 3000. And then wages, obviously extremely inflationary if you think about kind of where we are in terms of the employment cost index. But then when you kind of back into it from a wealth effect perspective, that's even more true. But lastly, wealth inequality, it's actually gotten significantly disinflationary. And that takes us back to that analysis we did on slide 86, which shows, you know, the consumers and the lower 50% of the households by wealth distribution only have about 2.3% of total wealth. So that's obviously moving in the wrong direction, or at least in terms of the wealth that's being concentrated among households here on slide 75 that are unlikely to spend that wealth, you know, that is disinflationary. So taking it back to slide 59, you know, we kind of walk you through all the various puts and takes in our dynamic factor model. And we're happy to sort of debate investors on, you know, what needs to be weighted where and what. But the reality is, We've jump conditioned in inflation, but we have not jump conditioned in inflation from a secular perspective in terms of the trending rate of change of inflation and the trending level that we're likely to see over the next few years.
Darius, on the bottom of page 59, you're showing 2020 through 2029, your mean projection for the weighted Z-score model of 2.8%. Now, how does that translate to an expected inflation rate during that same period?
Yeah, so that 2.8% is our model's estimation of the stationary mean of inflation, which is sort of the neutral level of inflation that the periodic function will sort of oscillate around. And so if you think about kind of, you know, going back to the prior, if you look at slide 8 kind of real quick, you think about inflation kind of bottoming around, let's say, 1% in recent cycles, kind of get up to 3%. And that the reality is a stationary mean for that whole function was really somewhere around 1.8%. Well, effectively, what we're arguing is that, if you take everything into account that actually matters in terms of projecting and influencing inflation dynamics here in the U.S. economy, the reality is we've only transposed ourselves higher in terms of that stationary mean around 60 to 100 basis points in terms of our math on that. Now, obviously, our math can be debated, but the reality is I haven't seen anyone really try to quantify inflation. I've seen a lot of quantification on, okay, there's structural deficits here and there, and this is why you need to be long this commodity or that commodity. But the reality is if we're not talking about a 1970 style runaway inflation, that obviously has material implications from an asset market perspective. If you think about kind of risk parity, the 60-40 portfolio and things of that nature, we show that on slide 76, which is based on our model's estimation, again, based on our quantification of these dynamics, it's very unlikely that we've achieved or crossed into the death of the 60-40 portfolio or risk parity. Obviously, it's been, not the best place to be, in terms of the backup and duration risk we've seen in recent months and recent quarters. But the reality is inflation needs to average a lot more than sort of 2.4 to 2.8% on a headline basis to kill sort of the inverse correlation, in our opinion, between stocks and bonds. That's what the blue line in this chart shows, which is a persistently positive correlation between stocks and bonds, the long bond relative to the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That persistently positive correlation was during a time where inflation, the stationary mean of inflation was 5%, or basically, nearly twice is what we're talking about it's likely to average in the ensuing decade or really throughout the 2020s. And so if you talk about it, the stationary mean of inflation being roughly half of that 5%, in our opinion, it's very unlikely the dynamics which really perpetuated the sort of the buildup of the inverse correlation between stocks and bonds that really began in earnest kind of in the late 90s, it's very unlikely that those functions, those features have really kind of changed in a material way that would perpetuate a return to a more persistently positive correlation. So, for a lot of institutional asset allocators out there listening to this, I know they're sort of, relieved to hear me say this. I'm sure other investors are doing similar work on this, but the reality is, in terms of our conclusions on it, it's very unlikely that these things have died. But I say, but if you look at slide 77, the key takeaway is that, investors, who are thinking about asset allocation from a longer term, from a strategic perspective, are obviously really quite focused on what to, substitutes for the 40% for the fixed income portion of the portfolio. And the reality is, on a real basis, if you hold bonds to maturity, you're going to lose money. That's clearly, I think we know that. I think everyone gets the joke on that. But the reality is that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to lose the inverse covariance between stocks and bonds that allows it to be a reasonable beneficiary in your portfolio. And Chris Cole at Artemis has talked about this as well. So the reality is, in terms of alternative asset classes, you really got to focus on the 60 if your goal is to make money in a higher inflation regime. Now, again, this higher inflation regime means the Fed put is lower, which obviously means stock prices are not likely to be as supported as they were in the prior decade, which likely means you should be, as an investor, trying to find some more juice in areas that have better fundamental stories, like crude oil, like certain pockets of the physical commodities markets. And so that's exactly the lesson we learned in 1970, which is, it wasn't necessarily the 40. It was partially the 40, but more importantly, it was the 60 or 70 configuring your asset allocation within that portion of the portfolio as it relates to increasing your exposure to commodities from a longer term perspective.
I want to talk about the portion that doesn't fit in the 60-40 conventional portfolio, and that's the portion that a lot of our listeners have put into a speculative trade that's all about inflation, which is gold or other precious metals. And the argument there, and I want to make sure we keep this in perspective, because you are describing what you think is a coming secular inflation period, but it's nowhere close to a 1970s double-digit percentage points. You're saying that inflation is going to persist for a long time and might even get as high as 3%. That's kind of your story. That's not anything close to the 1970s runaway inflation situation. A lot of people made a speculation, myself included, saying, look, we know governments are going to take the easy way out and they're going to do the wrong thing long term in terms of risks they're taking in order to do what they think is going to work in the short term. That means they're going to print money. They're going to debase the currency. That can only mean that eventually the price of gold goes to the roof. Well, guess what? We kind of got all of those predictions right, except the price of gold hasn't really gone through the roof yet. What's going on there? And does that mean that we're just not headed toward this secular inflation and price of gold's never going through the roof and that speculation's a dumb idea?
Yeah, no, I think gold, so I'll be the first to tell you that gold, you know, we do a lot of work in terms of quantifying things and understand a lot of these dynamics, I think, as well as most. But the reality is gold has confounded me and confounded a lot of investors in year to date. We actually recently sold our gold exposure as a function of it not really behaving the way we would have thought kind of in the prior sort of, you know, inflation deflation regime that we kind of saw in late 2021. So the reality is on gold, it certainly should behave reasonably well in kind of this sort of stagflationary dynamic that you could potentially see as a function of a lot of the inflation variables in the economy having taken a step forward, but not necessarily a lot of the growth dynamics in the economy having taken a step forward. If you think about kind of the main drivers of economic growth, which obviously are population growth and capital and things of that nature. So, you know, the reality is gold should be a favorable asset class from a longer term strategic perspective. And if you sort of, you know, you run any type of relative valuation model on gold, it's obviously extremely underpriced. But, you know, in terms of our model, in terms of how we think about managing macro risk, it's not about valuation. It's not about relative valuation or absolute valuation. Those things really matter from a longer term perspective. But if you're trying to get the next, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 quarters right, valuation has really no basis in terms of that decision-making process, certainly not for us. And, you know, empirically, it tends to not really work on that short term of a time frame. And then lastly, you made one quick comment that I'd like to sort of correct, which is going back to our secular inflation model. We're not saying inflation is likely to peter out at 3%. We're actually saying that the stationary mean of inflation is somewhere shy of 3%. Over the next, in this decade. And so the reality is you could get inflation readings much higher from a higher lows and higher highs perspective relative to the prior decade. But the reality is in terms of where we settle and oscillate around, it's likely to be 60 to 100 basis points higher, which again has asset allocation implications in terms of, you know, sort of forcing investors out of, you know, sort of digital economy, FANG type exposures, out of duration risk, and ultimately further into physical commodities, further into digital commodities and things of that nature. And that's exactly what we show on slides 110 and 111. 110, we show the relationship between the US dollar relative to cyclicals and defensives in the equity market. And clearly what we're arguing for is, you know, a US dollar that from a real basis, inflation that's higher should actually perpetuate a lower dollar from a longer term perspective. If you think about sort of real interest rates and those dynamics relative to the rest of the world, and ultimately that lower dollar should perpetuate a persistent outperformance of cyclicals relative to defensives, and it should perpetuate persistent sort of appreciation in physical commodities. That's what we show on slide 111. But the reality is all those things don't need to be priced in a linear straight line. The reality is we're probably going to approach some sort of crescendo here in the early part of 2022 in terms of both cyclicals relative to defensives and commodities relative to the dollar. And ultimately, that crescendo, in our opinion, should be sold and perhaps sold pretty forcefully as it relates to a potential larger than expected normalization process with respect to economic growth. And again, that's not just a U.S. phenomenon. Slide 87 and 88 will tell you it's a global phenomenon as well. But then also a potentially sort of more persistent normalization process with respect to fiscal and monetary policy. If you look at, you know, our estimations for how fiscal policy needs to contract over the next, you know, several quarters on 85, and then ultimately the Fed's reaction function on slide 103, you know, the normalization process, 2022, the summary of 2022, when it's all said and done, in our opinion, is going to be normalization. Normalization in growth, normalization in inflation, normalization in monetary policy, normalization in fiscal policy, and then ultimately normalization in asset markets, you know, out of some pretty lofty valuations for high beta cyclical exposures relative to their defensive counterparts.
Let's talk then about the asset classes that have moved big time in this reflation, such as copper and crude oil. Are you saying in the end of the year that those correct substantially to the downside?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, slide 104 is kind of the key takeaway on that. I keep going back to it because it's one of the more important slides in the deck, which is, look, whenever we roll past the peak in the U.S. and global growth cycles, it has material market impact in terms of forcing investors to book gains or out of for whatever reasons. If you think about VAR targeting and volatility targeting, there's a lot of technical reasons in terms of how asset markets work from a supply-demand perspective that will force investors out of those higher beta exposures. Now, again, we're long, you know, crude oil and uranium and things of that nature. So, you know, we ultimately understand that, hey, look, we're playing a dangerous game in terms of trying to time the market, you know, a cyclical peak in asset markets in terms of, you know, eventually them having to price in all that normalization that we just discussed. But the reality is that we're buyers of that dip. You know, again, who knows where the ultimate lows will be in this market cycle. But again, from a longer term strategic perspective, we know the dollar is overpriced. We know commodities are undersupplied. We know cyclicals are underowned relative to their defensive counterparts, you know, particularly the mega cap FANG type exposures. And ultimately, we know, you know, the value's significantly lower than where it has been in prior inflation episodes. If you look at slide 116, we know small caps are lower than where they've been in prior sort of growth or inflation episodes. And ultimately, you know, high beta on slide 114, you know, is lower than where it's been in prior inflation episodes and prior cycles. So we ultimately think there's longer term strategic appreciation. And there's also some shorter term strategic appreciation as it relates to the current reflation regime we're currently experiencing. But the reality is, if you go to slide 27, where we're showing the dominant market regime, which is currently, again, it's currently reflation, having a, you know, kind of had a narrow brief stint in deflation in late 2021. The reality is we've seen a lot of sort of volatility in our dominant market regime now casting process. And, you know, that's, you know, neither function of the model, neither function of myself. But the reality is it's just what markets are doing. They have a hard time showing trending sector and style factor leadership in the equity and credit markets. They've had a hard time showing trending leadership in the fixed income markets and in the commodity markets. And as a result of that, you know, looking at this slide and also looking at slide 26, we've seen a lot of sort of back and forth between the market regime and now casting in that process. The reason I bring it up goes back to slide 27, which is the last time we saw this kind of dispersion, this kind of volatility in our market regime now casting process was the summer of 2018. And obviously, we all know how that ended as it relates to sort of pricing in a material normalization in deflation, normalization in growth, a normalization in inflation after effectively two straight years where both growth and inflation were accelerating simultaneously. And obviously, monetary policy was just really starting to catch up to that in that time frame. And obviously, we saw a 20% decline in stocks, a pretty sharp decline in high beta risk assets, commodities in general, and a pretty material outsized excess returns in things like fixed income, the dollar, and gold. And that's effectively the scenario we're arguing for, most likely commencing late Q1, early Q2, and potentially persisting throughout the middle of the year. And again, it's very similar to what we outlined on slide 10, which is, hey, look, a couple of years of reflation was reflected in asset markets. It was aided and abetted by record monetary easing, record fiscal easing, and now all those dynamics are reversing. We have sort of potentially a record fiscal contraction. We know it's very likely we have a pretty material monetary policy normalization process ahead of us, certainly relative to a lot of asset market valuations and risk premia, and ultimately the growth and inflation dynamics, particularly from an expectation perspective, just remain out to lunch with respect to the kind of the potential economic growth, the potential GDP in the U.S. and global economy. So that to us is an issue.
Darius, let's bring this all together. Market views. We're talking about the potential for stock market downside that you're describing. How much downside are we talking, and what other views can you share with our listeners in terms of the, let's quantify as you put it. Darius, what are we looking at?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, going back to what I just said, which is, hey, look, we saw a 20% decline in Q4 18 as a function of that, all that normalization we saw then. It's very conceivable we could see a 20% decline here, if not longer, because the normalization that we're likely to experience in growth, inflation, and in monetary and fiscal policy over the intermediate to longer term is likely to be even more steep. That decline is likely to be even more steep in terms of normalization. So, you know, what we've put together here on slides 34 through 42 are some handy sort of back tests that incorporate a lot of what we're talking about from a near-term perspective, that's slide 34, and then from a medium-term perspective in terms of what we think asset markets are likely to have to price in, and kind of real quickly on slide 36, just showing you, hey, look, if you're long some of the things that should work in the current reflation regime that do not work in the sort of pending disinflation regime or the pending deflation regime, rather, those are the kinds of things that you need to think about booking gains in here and at the bare minimum hedging for you know, perhaps material downside kind of into the middle of this year. And so, you know, obviously, if you're thinking about this from a fresh capital perspective, you want your longs to be concentrated at the upper left side of those charts and your shorts to be concentrated in the bottom right. So those are all things we put together for investors every week, every day, every month here at 42 Macro. So hopefully if investors enjoyed the presentation, we'll come check us out.
Well, Darius, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. I'm going to encourage our listeners to do exactly that. Check you out at 42macro.com, and I really encourage you to peruse the entire chart deck. We didn't have time for all of it, but there's a lot of great content there. We've run out of time, so we're going to leave it there. Kevin Muir and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. If you're rethinking your portfolio like most investors right now, it's time to pay attention to one asset class Americans are overlooking. The Wall Street Journal even called it one of the hottest markets. I'm talking about blue chip art. That's right, contemporary artwork has taken the financial world by storm. It outpaced the S&P 500 from 1995 through 2020. And some hedge fund managers have allocated over 20% of their portfolios to art. Now you can too with Masterworks. They're the investment platform that recently sold a painting for a staggering $2.9 million, giving investors a net return of 31%. So you no longer have to be a billionaire to invest like one. Get priority access to their latest offerings at masterworks.art/macrovoices. That's masterworks.art/macrovoices. See important disclosures at masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts.
So, Eric, that was a terrific interview with Darius Dale. One of the things that I found most fascinating was how much you two were on the same page when it came to the Omicron variant.
Well, it's going to be really interesting. Obviously, this is something that nobody knows for sure. We deal with probabilities in this world, but it doesn't seem like the word is getting out. The smartest people, the same people like Dr. Chris Martinson and Dr. John Campbell, who had the story exactly right in January of 20, the guys that were saying this is a much bigger problem than the government says it is, take it seriously, we're headed towards lockdowns. Chris Martinson was ridiculed because he had a video showing lockdowns in China saying this is coming to your country, and people called him an alarmist nutcase. These really smart people who were very inclined to sound the bell and say we have a serious problem with an oncoming global pandemic are the same people that are now saying Omicron is most likely going to be what ends the pandemic. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not a virologist. I'm not an immunologist. I'm not any of these things. I just go by who seems to get stuff right. And these are the smartest guys that got the most stuff right that are all saying the same thing. So, you know, it's a gamble. Could be wrong. But everything I'm seeing says that we're going to get through this last difficult bout with Omicron. And it won't be easy. It will be half of the planet getting sick, at least for a few days. Some people will die as a result. It'll be sad for a lot of families, unfortunately. But I think it's going to end the pandemic, and I think that it's going to be a huge growth wave after that. We'll see if it really happens. But I want to come back to an article that you penned, which was picked up by Bloomberg this week. It's called "The Bond Market Refuses to Accept Economic Reality." What do you mean by that? Usually it's the market that debunks the government's refusal to accept economic reality and sets them straight. What are you talking about here, Kevin?
Well, I am loath to say that the bond market has got it wrong, but I really believe the bond market has got it wrong. And to explain why I feel this way, I think we should go back 40 years to the beginning of this great bull market in bonds, which was when Paul Volcker came in and broke the back of inflation. And at that point, it was very common for market participants to believe that inflation could never stop. There was a very famous fellow at Salomon Brothers, Henry Kaufman, who was called Dr. Doom, and he predicted just never-ending inflation. And for those that came up and said, you know, I think bonds are a great buy here and that they're going to end up being a terrific investment, people laughed at them and said that they were certificates of confiscation because they lost in real terms so much money. And ever since then, Eric, we've had a situation where anytime the economy has needed any sorts of tuning, the government has done it through monetary means. And what do I mean by that? Well, if we had a situation where there was too much inflation, the Federal Reserve would raise interest rates. If we had a situation where the economy went into a recession or a dip, they would lower interest rates. But what this had the effect of doing was encouraging more and more borrowing from the private sector. So each time you got an economic slowdown, the government would lower rates to try to solve it and encourage more borrowing. And what we found was over these 40 years that the amount of borrowing from the private sector just kept going up and up and up. And so therefore, each time you needed less interest rate rises to cause the economy to roll over. Finally, we got to a period in the great financial crisis where the economy rolled over from the rate hikes and the government went and tried to lower rates, and they lowered rates to zero, and lo and behold, nothing worked. The private sector had borrowed too much. We had hit the zero bound and they couldn't revive the patient. So what did the government do? The government went and the Federal Reserve tried all sorts of extraordinary monetary stimulus measures. They did quantitative easing. They did Operation Twist. Some countries even experimented with negative rates. And although at the time there was lots of people that worried that we were about to have hyperinflation and that this was going to cause the collapse of the U.S. dollar, there was the very famous op-ed to Ben Bernanke that was signed by a whole host of different market strategists and very renowned economists saying that this was a mistake. It didn't happen. We didn't get any of the extraordinary inflation that they were predicting, and the dollar didn't collapse. Now, we know why that is today. The reality is that when you put a monetary stimulus into an economy that is already has too much debt, it doesn't do anything. It just gets, it sits fallow in the financial system. It ends up as reserves in the bank's balance sheet, and the Federal Reserve has to mop up that liquidity with the offering interest rates to keep them from going down below zero. But at the time, we didn't understand that. Now, if we fast forward to 2020, we get COVID crisis, and now all of a sudden the government is facing the largest recession that they've ever seen, largest, quickest, most scary recession that we've probably seen since World War II. And the response was very similar to World War II in terms of the fiscal side. We went and did massive, massive fiscal. Now, we also did monetary stimulus at the same time, but the main point is that they did massive fiscal, which was dramatically different than the response that they did at 2008 during the great financial crisis. If we remember back to the great financial crisis, at the time, the Reinhardt and Rogoff book, This Time is Different, was all the rage. Everyone thought that too much debt had gotten us into this problem, so therefore the government had to pull back. And I always cite this stat that if you look at the government, federal government's real kind of the discretionary aspect of their budget, the amount of the discretionary spending went up, and you chart that over the previous three or four decades, there had only been 3 years when it had fallen. I think it was 1962, 1968, and then 1 year in the Clinton. Every other year, we had the government spending more year after year. Well, enter 2008, they think that the debt is a problem, and we have 4 years in a row where that falls. So that was a dramatically different response than the COVID crisis. The COVID crisis, we went and did the largest deficits that we've ever experienced. And at the time, there was all sorts of people that were extremely bearish, and they thought there was no way the government could fill the recessionary hole that was going to be created by the COVID. But much to many people's surprise, it was filled. And what was most interesting, it was actually filled too much. It actually created the inflation that we're worried about. So now, when I'm looking at the bond market and asking, what are they getting wrong? What I want to stress is, for the first time since 1982, the consumer is leaving a recession in better shape than they entered. In 2008, when we went into the great financial crisis, we had a situation where the consumer indebtedness was 100% of GDP. Since then, it's fallen. We are now 75% of GDP. So we have a situation where the consumer is actually much more able to borrow than they have at any other time in the last 20 years. Not only that, we have a situation where the millennials have put off having children. And although everyone thinks that they're different, I suspect the millennials are going to be just like every other generation. They're going to have children. They're just maybe a little bit later and maybe have less, but there's still going to be a little bit of a millennial baby boom that I think is going to occur. And then when you combine that with the fact that we have a trend from offshoring all of our manufacturing base, we've looked at this pandemic and we've said to ourselves, well, wait, maybe having all of our manufacturing in China or Vietnam is not a good idea. Maybe we should have some at home. So when I look at the private corporation side, it seems to me clear that they're going to be spending on CapEx as they bring some of that manufacturing home. So I think it's ironic that at the very time everyone is given up on private sector credit creation, we have the seeds being planted for one of the biggest booms in private sector credit creations that we've experienced in the past 20 years. And ultimately, that is what I think the bond market is missing. They're all assuming that there is going to be no desire to take up and borrow, because that has been the trend for the past 40 years. Each time there's required less and less of a rate hike for the economy to roll over. And the reason it's required less and less of a rate hike for the economy to roll over is because there's been more and more debt in the system. This time is different because the government went and did the biggest fiscal spending they've ever done. And yes, you might say that that is debt as well, but the reality is that the government is not financially constrained like the private sector is. So, Eric, what I'm seeing here is a bond market that is not appreciating the potential strength of this economy, which actually plays very much into your argument about the Omicron, that on the other side of this, we could have a return of economic growth like we haven't seen before. And I look at the Fed's terminal rate. The terminal rate of Fed funds is currently 1.75 to 2, somewhere around there. That, to me, doesn't seem anywhere near high enough.
Well, Kevin, I think that your thesis is going to be proven out one way or the other in the next several months. And the reason I say that is if Dr. Chris Martinson and Dr. John Campbell are right and Omicron really is going to decisively end the pandemic, my prediction is that we're going to see a massive increase in leisure travel and discretionary spending. And the logic is very simple. People have been cooped up for 2 years, and first of all, they're sick of being cooped up, and they're quite ready for a vacation. But what I think is more important, and certainly this is my own feelings, a lot of people, myself included, I think probably hadn't traveled, hadn't taken a vacation in a while, and are just feeling like, you know what? I've learned something. You can't take tomorrow for granted. You can't assume that the rest of my life is going to be the way the last several years have been. It makes sense to seize every day and live life to its fullest. And if the whole world feels the way I do, they're going to spend and travel and party when this thing is over, and they're not going to stop, and they're going to have lots of stimmy checks in order to pay for it. So, and they're also going to have lending mechanisms that have been put in place in order to do it on credit. So, you know, am I right about that, or is everybody going to continue saving and just try to come out of this crisis, making the best of it, saving money for a rainy day? I have a feeling people who have any ability to spend, including on borrowed money, are going to spend. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Eric, and I think the bond market is really missing that. And when you talk about the ability to spend, I think that's a great point, because not only is the absolute amount of debt in the consumer decline from 100% to 75% of GDP, but we actually see, because of the combined lowering of interest rates, we see a situation where a percentage of disposable income that are spent on maintaining the current debt has never been lower. Never, never, never. This is in terms of, well, I shouldn't say never been lower. Never been lower since 1975 or something like that. So we're in a period where their ability for people to spend is being greatly underestimated. And there's lots of ramifications to that. We have a situation where I think bonds could be, instead of being the ballast for your portfolio, could be the anchor that drags it down. And not only that, what it means in terms of the stocks that you pick, Eric, no longer should you be buying the high-flying, long-duration assets, the top 8 technology stocks. It could be a return of the real economy stocks. We could see things like banks, insurance, industrials, energy, all those sorts of things that have been so hated and you know, things that people said that that's what your grandfather owns or your grandmother. Those are going to be the things that could be flying. And I had a line that I used. I said, boring is beautiful. I really think that for 2022 and onward, that the more boring your stock selection is, the better it's going to be.
Now, I want to clarify for our listeners' benefit, when you say that you don't think the bond market is anticipating this ability to spend that the economy has, what are you predicting? Are you saying that interest rates are going up or down from here?
Oh, I think they're going to go way, way up. And I suspect that what you'll see is that right now the curve is flattening because they are anticipating that the Federal Reserve will raise rates and then the economy will roll over quickly. That's when the, a terminal rate of the Fed runs, Fed funds rate, that's what that means. It means the rate upon which the highest point that the federal funds will be. Well, that level has been coming down, 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 down for the past 40 years. And my argument is that it's a lot higher than market participants believe. I see that Jamie Dimon recently said that the economy needs lots of interest rates hikes really quickly. And the reason he says that is because he sees that the strength in the economy, he sees the strength in spending. And everyone's worried because we've seen in the past, anytime the Fed's come and raised rates, well, what's happened is the economy and the market has rolled over. I am not as sure that the market doesn't have trouble, but I am increasingly confident that the economy doesn't have any trouble. And people need to remember that the economy is not necessarily the market. And although that the Federal Reserve wants to make sure that the stock market doesn't suffer collapse, they are not interested in maximizing the price of the S&P. They are interested in maximizing the real output, which is something that a lot of people have forgotten.
Kevin, I'd like to change the subject slightly and run some really crazy ideas by you that I've been thinking about as we talk about the bond market. And I'm talking really high level, big picture, long, long, long term, over the next several decades. I'm going to make the argument that the bond market no longer fulfills the purpose which we've been taught that it's supposed to fulfill. On the retail side, you look at the idea of the 60-40 portfolio, and look, bonds are just not a good investment anymore at these interest rates. Maybe if you're right, eventually we get back to normal interest rates and bonds are meaningful again. But for now, super low-yielding bonds, they're not a meaningful amount of return. So the whole 60-40 portfolio structure, I think, is seriously in question. On the institutional side, people use treasuries because they need pristine collateral, and there's lots of reasons to hold treasuries, and our institutional listeners understand them. I'm going to make this argument. I think that it would be better if there was a replacement for the entire asset class we know as the bond market, something that had much better tradability characteristics, so we didn't have all this BS about how you have to know somebody in order to sell an off-the-run issue of some bond because you got to have a connection to the right broker in order to get a decent price. We could get rid of all of that stuff, and you know, the place it's going to come from, I think, is this decentralized finance revolution. So far, the guys that invented cryptocurrency have been focusing on their cryptocurrencies, and I know you're not a fan of them. I'm not a big fan of them either. But that same underlying technology, I'm going to argue, could be used to build a much better mousetrap, a digital sovereign bond market, or a digital commercial bond market, for that matter, as well, that has completely totally different characteristics and is a superior replacement. I predict this is coming, a superior replacement for the entire fixed income asset class will be invented in the next 10 years. Question is adoption. If that happens, it really screws up the ability of most governments to kind of make their own rules and be in charge of their financing process for their own deficit spending. It would completely change the game for everybody, make the market a better place, but it would eliminate a lot of very deeply ingrained subsidies and preferences that exist in the market. What do you think about these ideas? I very easily anticipate and foresee the invention of the superior digital fixed income instrument that's just better than bonds. What I can't really map out in my mind is once that exists, you know, look, it's taken 12 years for the market to figure out what cryptocurrency is. How long is it going to take to figure out that there's a better mousetrap that replaces fixed income when you got a lot of old school guys trading that stuff?
Well, Eric, I'm going to say what I always tell my kids. That's what makes a market. Everyone has a different opinion. I'll take the other side of your trade. I don't think that's going to occur. And in a little bit of pushback, yes, you're correct that we are running out of collateral and that there is a demand for long-dated assets and even short-dated assets of pristine collateral. And that is part of the reason why the Federal Reserve has gone and done the $1.5 trillion reverse repo program. And I just look at it and think we're going to get the financial system is going to evolve. I completely agree with you there. The way that we use the plumbing is changing all the time. And it really started with the quantitative easing and the zero bound. And there's all sorts of different aspects of that. But I would say that the Federal Reserve is figuring out different ways to deal with it. And as problems occur, as such, as you say, not enough collateral, there are pristine collateral out there, they're coming up with solutions. And so I'll just take the other side of that. I think that you're going to find that those problems are going to go away. They're not going to be as much of a big deal as everyone thinks. And not only that, when we get a rip-roaring economy, there will be lots of fixed income instruments created as people go out and borrow more. So I suspect that the last thing that we're going to be worried about in the coming decade is the problem of not enough fixed income instruments to buy.
Oh, I think the problem that we're going to face is a superior fixed income instrument means that there's no market for the old style stuff. And that leaves a whole bunch of people, including sovereign nations, screwed in terms of their financing needs until they get on board. And I think it could be a very interesting time. But as you say, that's what makes a market. This one takes at least a decade to play out. So we can both claim that we got it right for a good solid year before we have to actually admit who was wrong.
Sounds good.
We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost.
So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support that we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all of the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric, spell with a K, and myself. Well, I'm going to give Patrick a plug here, Patrick Serezna. So on behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, Kevin Muir, thanks for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.